I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The Republican Party won control of the House of Representatives in 2010, the Senate in 2014. But in this election cycle, many Republicans are up for re-election. And with Donald Trump at the top of the GOP ballot, the fate of candidates sharing that ballot and control of the House and Senate are up for grabs. We're going to look at those battles. You can join us. What do you see coming down ballot if it's Trump, Clinton, Sanders at the top of the ticket? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. With me now from Washington is Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Robert Costa, welcome back to On Point.
Great to join you, Tom.
Also from Washington today, Susan Davis is here. She covers Congress in the 2016 election for NPR. Susan, welcome back to you.
Hey, Tom.
So we'll dive into the numbers and how it looks in the House and the Senate. Robert Costa, just for a minute, there's Mitch McConnell, and you can hear him in our conversation just now supporting Donald Trump, but also expressing all kinds of hesitation and, I'm not sure what word to put on it, discomfort, with exactly how Trump would be in office. He expresses confidence that the system would work to contain a President Trump. But what about the misgivings he expresses at the same time? It's an odd mix for someone who's endorsed the candidate.
As someone with a little Irish heritage, it kind of reminded me of some dark Irish humor there, some chuckles, but also a bleak outlook. And I think the moment in your interview, Tom, that was so telling was McConnell backstage with Trump at the National Rifle Association CONFAB a few weeks ago and urging the nominee to try to use a script and to use prepared remarks, and Trump just saying point blank, I don't like that, it's boring. And that's kind of the position the Republican Party's in, encapsulated in one moment backstage.
Susan Davis, you know the fits that some in the GOP are having these days over the Trump candidacy, and of course others swinging in behind the nominee. Where does Mitch McConnell sit in that range of Republicans that made him the first really big top dog to come on and endorse Donald Trump?
Well, what makes McConnell's job particularly difficult this year is that so many of his incumbents and open seat races that they're defending to hold the majority in the Senate run right through the presidential battleground. These are states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, New Hampshire, Colorado, and that the fate of those Senate candidates is very likely to be tied to the fate of the outcome of the presidential election. Now, what Mitch McConnell has said, and part of his strategy this year, is he's hoping voters will split their tickets. If state's going to vote for Hillary Clinton in a place like Ohio, he's still hopeful that a senator like Rob Portman will be able to have a voter that will split their ticket. The problem is voters don't really do that anymore. There's not really a lot of split ticket voters left. But again, Donald Trump has sort of, you know, flip the script on how conventional wisdom and how people vote and what this election year is going to be like. So it's certainly possible. And what he's doing, McConnell's doing, is he's not really trying to nationalize this election. He's not telling his incumbents to run with Trump. He's telling them to run the races they need to run. And when you talk to Senate campaign strategists, these senators are trying to run very localized races on very local issues. Now, whether that can work in a national election year is a matter for debate, but that's at least what they're trying to do.
Remind us of the numbers here, Susan.
Yeah.
The number of Senate seats up for grabs this year, the prospects for the Republicans. Let's just start with the Senate, the chances of it flipping from Republican to Democratic control.
Well, you know, Democrats have a very good shot at this. Now, there's 34 Senate seats that are up for grabs in 2016, but only about 9 of them are really competitive. There's about 9 races that are going to decide the makeup. And Republicans only have a 4-seat majority in the Senate. So Democrats need to net either 4 seats and hold the White House to get the majority, because the vice president is the tiebreaker in that situation, or they need to win 5 outright. And in the makeup of these races, if there's only about 9 competitive races, Republicans are on defense. They're defending 7 of those races. There's only 2 Democratic incumbents up this year. So Democrats have a lot more resources to spend because they're not defending more of their own races. And Trump is a very volatile figure at the top of the ticket. So Democrats have a lot of built-in advantages going into this election cycle. That said, the Trump argument and a lot of the Republican argument is that in a lot of these races, like Pennsylvania, Ohio, New Hampshire, is can he inspire and motivate more voters to come to the polls to make up for the people that he has been alienating, like women and Hispanics and other communities? And that is the question we don't know. Initially, you know, there was this wisdom that the polls would show that these races were not going to be competitive at all. But recent polls have suggested that in a lot of these races, it's going to be very, very tight. I think Ohio is a very good example of that. So, you know, there is a shot for Republicans to hold on to the Senate, but the built-in structural advantage of 2016 leans in the favor of Democrats just by the metrics from the onset.
Robert Costa, in which states does the GOP look most vulnerable? Among those nine competitive seats, which states look like might decide control of the Senate?
When you look at a state like Illinois with Mark Kirk, a very vulnerable senator, he and someone like Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania both barely won in Tea Party year of 2010, and they faced difficult challenges, strong female Democrat opponents in both of those states. I think Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire is someone who's more of a murky question with regard to how Trump affects her race, because she could use some of Trump's populism. New Hampshire has a strong anti-illegal immigration streak, but at the same time, there are a lot of moderates who've moved up from Massachusetts, and that race is more of a toss-up. But I think that the big purple states that are leaning blue, like Illinois, Pennsylvania, they could be for sure where the Senate is decided. In Florida, that's why Marco Rubio is being recruited. To try to stay in and stay a senator, because McConnell and others are nervous that Florida could fall away unless they have someone of stature on the top of that ticket.
And how do you see the Trump chemistry playing out for those people? Are they, as Susan says, Mitch McConnell wants to keep it local. Are the senators that you're following keeping it local? Are they avoiding Donald Trump in their stump speeches, in their public remarks? How are they engaging or not engaging with the apparent nominee?
Susan is spot on. That is the consensus that you have to run a local race, and the advisories you're getting from the national party for many of these candidates is to run like you're running for mayor, run like you're running for sheriff. At the same time, when you look at the agenda coming from Paul Ryan in the House, more of a nationalized agenda when it comes to tax cuts and economic growth. It's hard for some of these senators, like a Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, to really localize a race because there is such a national wave. And so as much as they do try to localize, I think when you talk to the strategists in many of these Republican Senate races, they say the most important thing for them is navigating how this national terrain is going to unfold over the next few months and finding some level of safety and stability for your campaign.
Susan Davis, take us to the House of Representatives and how that looks. Seats up and what is imagined as a conceivable swing one way or the other there in the outcome in November?
Well, Republicans in the House right now have the highest majority they've had, I think, since pre-1929. So they have a lot of seats to lose. They have a lot of room to work with. Mm-hmm. Again, Democrats are favored to at least pick up seats in the House of Representatives, partly because of that historically high majority, and partly because national years tend to benefit Democrats more. Republicans have made their gains in the during the Obama administration in these midterm election years in 2010 and 2014. When we have national elections, when the Democratic, big D, Democratic voters engage more, Democrats do better. So that conventional wisdom seems to hold this year. They do have some structural advantages in the House as well. The question is, could they capitalize off of a Trump nomination enough to put more congressional races into play to give them a chance at winning the majority? That is not outside the realm of possibility. You know, it's still early, and we're still going through primary races and primary season in the House. What doesn't help Democrats is I don't think that they anticipated that Trump would be the nominee. I think, a year ago when it seems very far-fetched. And so they didn't necessarily have the candidate recruitment that they needed to put warm bodies into these races to make enough of them competitive to have a shot. What we don't know, though, is does Trump become such a tectonic plate shift in some of these, one of the places Democrats look at is suburban races where they think that they have a chance to win. And in some areas that have been sort of reliably center-right Republican, but that if there is a real disruptive force, a Democrat could have a shot. So there is they're favored to pick up seats. The majority still seems out of reach. And structurally, the way that the House is drawn is there's just not that many competitive races. You know, there's 435 seats in the House. As of right now, maybe three or four dozen of those seats are truly considered competitive. So Democrats would have to sweep the board to have a chance at a takeover. But, nonpartisan election analysts at this point, at this stage of the race, give a best guesstimate of about a 10 to 12 seat pickup for Democrats.
Robert Acosta, we just talked with Mitch McConnell. We heard his very audible ambivalence about Donald Trump, and yet he's endorsed him. Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, has not. What's the difference in either the position he's in as a leader there or his principled view of the world, you think, that's led him to wait and McConnell to dive in?
Paul Ryan is someone who grew up in the conservative movement, working at Jack Kemp's side, the late New York congressman, supply-side advocate for tax cuts. And Ryan sees himself really as a conservative first and a Republican second. And then McConnell is a party man, someone who grew up in the Kentucky where the Democrats ruled for years, and he helped to build the modern Kentucky Republican Party. And he takes pride in being a Republican. And though he does have conservative views and he's seen as an ideologue, at the core of his political persona is Mr. Republican. Mm-hmm. I think that's the nuanced divide between the two.
And so that leaves him more concerned with the party position than with the principle, perhaps.
I think it leaves him more concerned with the survival of the party and the unity of the party. McConnell, I'm sure if he was right with us here, he'd argue that he has his principles as well.
Sure.
But the point is, McConnell does not like to see party infighting, and he is someone who has risen through the ranks in Congress, who puts the party first. Ryan is a unique figure, someone who was plucked out of a committee chairmanship in a time of tumult in the House to take over the speakership, never really wanted the job, and doesn't see himself as a traditional speaker, kind of rounding up the members and herding the cats.
Let's go to John in Swampscott, Massachusetts. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Nice to talk to you, Mr. O'Connell. I wanted to say I voted for Obama, but I'm going to be voting for Trump this time around. And I just want to know what you think of, you know, the bank bailouts, because that, to me, all that money that went to these banks in Wall Street, if it had gone to creating jobs and job programs and everything, maybe the bottom would have... the people at the bottom would have had money to go out and spend and got the economy back themselves. And I, you know,
well, what do you think that President Trump would do, John? What do you think Trump would do that President Obama has not?
Well, I don't know. I mean, but I'm just ready for a change. I don't blame it on Obama and all the regulations. That it might be part of the problem, obviously. But Bush is the one who started the bank bailouts and all that money they're sitting on all these companies now. I just think if that money had been taken, somehow put into the economy for the average guy, you know, again, job programs or incentives for small businesses to hire people, to train them, whatever.
Yep.
At least from the bottom up, you would have had money coming in the economy, and I think that would have built it back instead of, you know, the disparity we have now because of people at the top got all the money. They bought up housing cheap. The hedge funds were able to do it through Fannie Mae, everything.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And they renting back to these people who would have had smaller mortgages if they could have bought.
John, I appreciate your call. Susan Davis, right there. John says he's likely to swing from being an Obama voter to a Trump voter. Is that Mitch McConnell has talked about the Republican Party bringing in more working class members. Donald Trump talks about the same thing. How significant a swing of that kind of voter who's concerned about being stuck at the bottom while the top goes does just fine, how significant might that be in November in terms of the Trump turnout and, for that matter, congressional performance?
You know, I think it's hugely significant. So much of this election has been driven by the force of personality, right? But we forget that underneath the personalities in this race, that economic insecurity is probably one of the single biggest drivers of voters in this election right now. And what the caller said, you hear all the time when you talk to voters, that they're worried about jobs, they're worried about the economy. And that is part of what has made Trump's appeal so clear, is that his story and his narrative of being a businessman who can build jobs is, you know, remarkably appealing. I would say, to the caller's point, though, when he talked about the bank bailouts, when he was referring to what we called his TARP, or the Troubled mm-hmm. Asset Relief Program, that was happened after the economic collapse in 2008, you know, that program was fairly successful, and the government made all of its money back. If anything, it made a profit off of TARP. So, you know, it just goes to the show, though, that the perception of voters that the banks were bailed out and we lost money is more enduring than the fact that the program was actually very successful and the U.S. government made all of its money back on that program, and it helped stabilize the economy. Mm-hmm. But everyday voters, pocketbook issues, they're not feeling it. And I think we're seeing that play out day in day on the campaign trail.
Robert Costa, if it should be, if John and others swing in behind Trump and it's Trump in the White House and Republicans should hold on and Mitch McConnell's still Republican majority leader and Paul Ryan's still in there, let's say, what would that look like? How would that Republican Congress work with a President Trump, to your mind?
I think they would be guides for Trump. Trump would not enter the White House with any kind of governing experience, doesn't have deep ties in Washington. I think what would be important to watch is the vice presidential pick for Trump, because he's looking for perhaps a Washington insider, someone who could bring congressional experience to help him build a legislative agenda. But you don't see Trump running right now on a certain kind of legislation, any kind of economic or foreign policy that's specific. So he would probably take cues from those party leaders, and the party leaders would probably let Trump take the lead when it comes to trade deals and some of the things that have animated the Trump campaign.
So I'm not sure where that goes. Donald Trump says a lot of things. Do you think they'd really keep him in the sort of between the guide rails, or Mitch McConnell expresses confidence that they would? Is it that clear to you that in policy and legislative proposals, pushes, Donald Trump would be, you know, stay in the median?
It's hard to say. I mean, he's such an unpredictable and combative figure, but he's also a pragmatic political persona. He's not a figure that is driven by a certain idea. It's a populism, a personality-driven politics. And so they think that could be more actually controlled than someone like a Ted Cruz if he was elected, because they think Cruz would really have an ideological agenda that he'd want to enact.
Can you imagine, Susan, Donald Trump sitting down with Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan to make the deal, craft the legislation?
You know, we don't know if Donald Trump can cut a legislative deal, but we know that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell can, because they both have.
And of course, never under a president who would be quite like that one, if that's the way it went. Susan Davis, congressional reporter for NPR, thank you so much for looking ahead to the battles for the Hill coming up in November. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Robert Costa, national political reporter at the Washington Post. Thanks for being with us, Robert.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.